Hey there, everybody. Welcome back inside the studios at KATE. I'm Nate Dickinson alongside Mike Grimm, who joins us over the phone every single Monday to talk about what's going on with the Minnesota Gophers and also everything else around Minnesota sports, too, during this time where, well, the Gophers aren't doing all that much. Mike, I guess I just want to start by asking what's been going on up there at the university, just because there's so little that we know and so little precedent. I know I kind of explained this at the start of last week when we talked, too, but I mean, it's not going to change for at least a little while. I'm still going to be interested in how people are handling this, at least through the first stages where people are really just trying to learn what exactly this new normal is for now.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of, you know, standard operating procedure. I know, like, for example, football is off this week. Now, they got a couple of practices in last week. They are allowed to work out. They're allowed to weightlift. They're following protocols within that, social distancing, mask wearing, you know, doing what they have to do to try to stay safe. They are getting tested now weekly, once a week, which is less than it would have been had there been games. They would have been tested three times and maybe even four times a week. So that part has been less. But it's still, you know, they're still getting tested each week to make sure that, you know, what's happening. This week they're off. In fact, I think some of the guys even were able to get out and go home and then would likely be back, even though most of the classes are going to be online, you know, distance learning, so to speak, virtual class, whatever you want to call it. I think most of the team will be back, will be living on campus throughout the fall. And as mentioned, they will get to lift weights and work out and try to better their game. And that's the angle Fleck is taking. PJ Fleck said, you know, look, we're going to take advantage of, you know, we don't get to play games. That stinks. They would have preferred to, you know, they wanted to, but they also understand the decision. They're okay with the decision, and now they're going to use it as a positive. Let's use this 4 months where we don't have games to work as hard as we can to get better, dedicate ourselves in the classroom, all those things, you know, and that's where the football part of it is. The other sports, it depends. I know in just talking with like women's tennis, for example, I just had a conversation today, in fact, with some of the women's tennis team, and one of their top players is going to stay home in the fall semester because there's no competition. She's going to work out. She's going to take, obviously, University of Minnesota classes online and then return in the spring with the team and be able to compete. So, you know, it's a mixed bag, and as you would have guessed, it would be.
Are there people worried about their futures just with the university, with what might have to happen with sports being either postponed further or canceled entirely and entire sports being wiped out? Are there people concerned about what's happening and wanting to know what's going to happen with their entire teams?
Well, I think they would probably be concerned. Is it alarm? Is it like, hey, we're in danger of getting cut? I don't know the answer to that. I don't think so. I don't think Minnesota's at the stage that they're ready to cut sports. That said, I mean, there are no guarantees, and I certainly have not, I've had many over the years conversations with Mark Coyle, and I'm a big fan of his, but I have not, quite honestly, had any specific conversations with him about, you know, varsity sports and budgets and those kind of things. I do know this, the cuts at Iowa last week have certainly put a shockwave in some sports around the country. Like men's gymnastics, for example, is with Iowa dropping, the Big Ten, I believe, is down to 5 or 6 teams that has men's gymnastics, and the entire country now has 14 teams. That's it. That's all they have for men's gymnastics. So there is a real fear that if one or two more go, that could just about end it. And so I don't think the fear, say, at Minnesota is, oh, the Gophers could cut it. I think the fear is if two or three others cut it, and now you're down to 10 or 11 teams, and that's it for the entire country, that it just becomes like, it'd basically be a conference, right? A national conference if you're down to 10 or 11 teams. So, and I don't even know what the bylaws of the NCAA are in terms of requirements for the number of teams before you can offer a championship. So I think that's the scary part. It isn't like Mike Burns, the men's gymnastics coach, and coaches from around the country. I don't think it's like, oh man, my school could cut, although certainly any school could cut it. I think the question becomes, at what point does it no longer become viable, right? Just in sheer number of sports or sheer number of teams in the sport. I mean, there's only 14 teams that compete in men's gymnastics in the entire country right now. So if one or two more go here in the spring, now it brings into question the rest of them and what, you know, is it worth it to fund? I would say it is, but I think the more teams that drop, the more likely it is that men's gymnastics might not be here for the long haul. And that's the scary part. And I know for a fact that all 14 head coaches have been on multiple Zoom calls over the past week in trying to determine what, you know, what's going on with that, just to try to, you know, are there things that we can do to save the sport? Even though they're already running on bare minimums, and let's face it, even at Minnesota, which was a national runner-up 2 years ago, they finished second in the country, and yearly contend for the Big Ten, which is the best men's gymnastics conference there is. They're working out and practicing in a facility that just isn't very up to date. But they can't, you know, their sheer existence is always kind of on the fringe, so it's hard to go in and demand things, right? And say, hey, we need a new gym to work out in. We need new equipment. We need a bigger travel budget. And, in fact, I think the tenor of much of these calls in recent days amongst all 14 coaches in the country is, man, what can we do to trim it down even more to make it so that we don't get cut? And so what does that mean? Does it mean you get by without as much gear? Does it mean you cancel a couple of road trips? Does it mean, you know, what can you do to make it less attractive, so to speak? And, you know, I think you and I talked about it last week. Men's gymnastics at Minnesota cost about $800,000 a year to run, okay? And that's a good chunk of change. That said, this is an athletic department that generates over $100 million in revenue on most normal years. And I get it. This is more than just a bump in the road, especially if football's not played. But my fear is it's a short-term solution that creates a long-term consequence, if that makes sense. So you're cutting an entire sport at Iowa, for example, because you're down revenue in 2021. If football and everything else gets back to normal, and, you know, I would think a year from now we would be heading into the fall, and from a medical standpoint, I think we're going to be much closer to normal than not, then you have solve some of those issues, because the money will be coming back in, and can you survive that in the short term? So that's a long answer in terms of, I think men's gymnastics is really the one in the meat grinder currently, and I hope at Minnesota that it stays.
How many sports are there that are in situations like where men's gymnastics is at or could be headed there?
Well, I think that's the big one, you know, and like I said, the weird thing is, so you save, let's say you save $1 million, you know, right now I think last year men's gymnastics, or 2 years ago men's gymnastics, the budget was $800,000. They don't create any revenue, so whatever you spend is a loss, but that's smaller than what the women's basketball team or the volleyball team would lose. They do create revenue, but they also have a much bigger travel budget, more scholarships. I mean, scholarships alone cost the athletic department $14 to $17 million a year. I think people are under this misconception that, you know, athletes go to school and it's just a write-off, that the schools don't get that money. Well, the athletic department writes a $14 to $17 million check every year they send across campus to the general school for those scholarships. They're not free. It's not like no scholarship's free. Like if you get a scholarship, you know, whatever, the Mike Grimm Family Foundation scholarship winner, that person goes to school, if it's been funded, I'm just making one up, just to throw a name out, that scholarship isn't free. The school's getting money from the donor. The kid goes to school for free, but trust me, all those scholarships, I mean, that's what they're funded for. The school gets that money. It's not just a giveaway, and the same goes with athletic scholarships, 750 athletic scholarships, and it's $14 to $17 million a year. So from that standpoint, there are sports that cost more, that lose more than men's gymnastics. But at this point, because of, again, that there's that viability issue, it's trickling. Are there other sports in danger? I'm sure there are. Golf would be one, I suppose, particularly in the northern climate. Baseball, not at Minnesota, but baseball in some other northern places. mean, Iowa State, Wisconsin, Northern Iowa, none of those teams have had baseball. I mean, Wisconsin has not had baseball since the early 1990s. So, you know, I don't think baseball is going away in college athletics, and I don't think any Big Ten team is going to cut baseball. But it, you know, based on rules, based on budgets, based on, you know, different things, I think there are some, there are more sports that are more likely to be cut. And the weird thing is it comes at a time where other sports are gaining traction, and it's a shame because I look at lacrosse and the growth of lacrosse, especially here in Minnesota. If it were a different time, this would be a good opportunity for, if not Minnesota, St. Thomas to start a Division I hockey or a Division I lacrosse program in Minnesota, men's and women's. But right now, that's going to be impossible, right? But you look at the popularity of lacrosse, high school lacrosse in Minnesota, in Wisconsin, in some of the other areas, the state of Illinois and Chicago in specific, where you could recruit. Like, most of those kids are now going to the East Coast because that's where most of the lacrosse teams are. And I'm not saying it's a bevy of talent, but there are some talented kids. And it's a fun sport to watch if you haven't watched it. But in this environment, that sport is facing a plateaued growth, I think, because colleges are currently not in a position to be adding sports that are growing. And that's unfortunate in my mind, but it is what it is.
Mike Grimm joining us here on KATE. Mike, I want to get at least a little bit closer to on-the-field stuff here. Last week, an NCAA committee or Division I Council, the D1 Council, recommended that athletes in the fall get waivers for the 2020 season and then another year of eligibility along with that. What do you feel like people who have that opportunity are considering doing with it, whether it be like seniors on coming back or players who may have pro hopes at some point getting that extra year back? And what else would be like some of the complications around doing something like that if you're a player that like maybe goes beyond just what we see on the TV screen when people say they're going to get an extra year?
Yeah, I'm still a little confused by it, honestly, because the Big Ten has come out and said that the fall sports have been postponed, that they're pushing for spring. I mean, there are multiple athletic directors in the Big Ten that are on record saying, you know, we think we're going to play in the spring. And so my thought is, well, if that's the case, then you don't have to worry about that, right? Because if they play in the spring, that's their year. They're going to use their year of eligibility there. They wouldn't have to do that. Now, if it's a contingency plan, look, if we don't play in the spring, they get the year back, then that creates, you know, it does create some unique situations because, again, it becomes a budgetary thing. You're paying for every one of those scholarships, and you have recruits committed. I think football, it creates a big nightmare, quite honestly. So let's say you have 14 seniors, you have 25 freshmen coming in, and you have 85 scholarships. That's not going to work. It's not going to work if all 14 kids come back. If you don't play in the spring and those years are saved. So what are you doing? You're going to tell high school kids they can't come to your place? Are you going to tell seniors that have poured their heart and soul in it that they have to matriculate on and not play? Are there going to be waivers that say, oh, okay, the scholarship limit is 85, but because of this rule for 2 years, we're going to make it 95? And is a school who's already strapped for money going to be willing to send an additional check to the school to pay for 10 more scholarships in football and 5 more in volleyball and 6 more in track and whatever else, right? And in soccer. So I think, I don't know if we know any answers yet at this point. I'm a little confused yet. If the plan indeed is to play in the spring, at this point, I'm not sure why that part of the legislation needed to be put in place yet. Because if all this stuff happens in the spring, as the Big Ten has said it's hoping to, then what are we putting that plan in place for at the current moment, I guess would be my question.
Mike, why doesn't the NCAA seem to have any power in any of this? Because I mean, it's not just this. It seems like when it came to playing or not playing, the NCAA was pretty much silent. Now they're trying to do this thing with the waivers. But like you said, if the Big Ten says no, I feel like everyone thinks that it's the Big Ten that's going to have the final word. Why doesn't the NCAA have any power in this? And what does that mean for the future of them having power just kind of in general? Because I feel like both players and conferences are realizing that the NCAA doesn't have any power when it comes to the big stuff.
Yeah, a couple of things. So, and it's hard to explain. So the NCAA basically has no oversight over football other than the rules, recruiting rules and guidance and compliance and all of that. The football championship, the New Year's Six bowl games, all that stuff, that's controlled by the schools. That money is 100% goes to the schools. I think there's a big misconception that the NCAA, it creates billions of dollars, but the NCAA doesn't get a penny of the football revenue. They make their money on March Madness. They sanction that event, the basketball tournament. They get the TV rights money, and then they distribute that out to the schools, which was a big cut because there was no March Madness last year. But that's where the NCAA gets its money. Football, other than rules, they have no control over any of that. That is all put on by school presidents. I agree the NCAA has a lot of issues, and they don't make sense in a lot of silly things. But quite frankly, they have to make rules upon rules because coaches and administrators continue to push the envelope looking for loopholes. And when loopholes get found, guess what? The NCAA has to come up with a way to try to close the loophole. And guess what that ends up with? An 800-page book of rules because something you didn't think about and a smart coach comes up with it and is like, well, that's an unfair advantage and we want to try to keep it fair, so we got to put a new rule in place. And all of a sudden, a rule about a rule about a rule and, you know, addendum 17A on one single rule because it continues. So, look, I'm not the hugest fan of the NCAA. I do think they get a bad rap at times. And then in regard, I have seen this a lot, that people suggest, like, where was the NCAA on the coronavirus and why didn't they have national standards? And the answer is exactly what you're seeing, because what is relevant in the West Coast might not be relevant in the East Coast. What's relevant in the Midwest and the Upper Midwest might not be relevant in the Southeast. And what's relevant in a big school conference like the Big Ten, where there's ample resources to pay for three tests a week for 700 student athletes, might be different than what Northern Illinois can pay in the MAC. So I think the NCAA, I don't think they were passing the buck as a lot of people think. I think they were saying, look, everybody's kind of playing under a different set of rules. How can we put some national, rule in place that would fit everybody? Now, they can put a baseline of protocols in place, certainly. But, again, that can change, like what St. Thomas and St. John's and Augsburg and Concordia Moorhead can do is certainly different than what Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, Oklahoma, UCLA, and big schools can do. So how can there be some sort of national mandate? I don't really, frankly, have a huge issue with the NCAA saying, look, each region, each conference has a different set of priorities. Each region, each conference has a different set of health issues. The coronavirus is different in certain areas than the other. Your schools better than some guy. I mean, half the the NCAA is kind of in a no-win situation because half the criticism is, how does a guy sitting at a desk in Indianapolis know what's good for a student who transferred from Pittsburgh to Minnesota? Well, then all of a sudden, a week later, it's like, how come the NCAA can't mandate something to and my argument is, well, the guy in Minnesota knows more about what's happening in the coronavirus. The guy in the Big Ten knows his conference better than some guy sitting at a desk in Indianapolis at the NCAA office. So I don't, frankly, have a huge issue with the NCAA passing the buck on this and letting the regions, letting the conferences, letting the divisions kind of set their own rules here. And does it create a little mess? Yes. But we're seeing why they didn't. The Big 12, the ACC, and the SEC all believe they can play. The Big 10 and the Pac-12 believe they can't. So what was the NCAA supposed to do? Say to the Big Ten, you have to play, or say to the SEC, you can't play? I don't think that's the place of the NCAA to put some national mandate on right now. I think it's wise, frankly, to leave it up to the conferences. My opinion only. Others may differ with it.
Again, Mike Grimm with us here on KATE 1450. Mike, before we let you go, there's been a lot of sports news going on around sports in Minnesota, but outside of the Minnesota Gophers. So I just wanted to just real quickly rattle off a couple of topics for you and just get your takes real quick, just a few sentences on each thing before we let you go, on stuff outside going on with Minnesota. First off, I want to hear just what you think about the first week of the NBA playoffs in general, but also Minnesota Timberwolves pick up the first pick in the NBA draft during the middle of the playoffs last week, too, and that's big for the Timberwolves, obviously.
No doubt, huge. Now, that said, it sounds like this might be a year where there's three or four guys that could potentially be, you know, that number one pick, that having pick two or three might be the same as having pick one. I mean, there's been years like that. Certainly, there's always years where, you know, some guy that gets picked 12th is better than anybody that got picked ahead of him or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, having the one pick is prime real estate. It can excite a fan base. It can be used as leverage. It can be used as an asset. It can be used to acquire talent. I mean, it just allows you a lot. It can allow you to now even go out and talk to people involved in the draft to figure out, you know, who, you know, more specific. As the guy with the one pick, you can go out and talk about contracts with this pick and then say, well, what's this pick want? And you can go from there. So there are some huge advantages to that, and I just think there's an exciting aspect to it that helps build the franchise. And, you know, if they hold the pick, which I think they will, they use the pick, what's that put? That's two number ones and a number two in your likely starting lineup with a couple of other lottery picks. I mean, the price to pay is you've lost a lot of games for a number of years, and hopefully at some point that pays off in having a roster now talented enough, full of lottery picks, that you can make a run in the postseason here, and we'll see if that formula works. It seems that for many in the NBA, the teams that win it have built through some the draft and two through through free agency or trades, getting veterans. I mean, when Cleveland won, they got, you know, LeBron to come as a free agent. They got Love in the trade. They, you know, they got a couple of other guys in free agency as well. The Warriors, a lot of that talent was drafted. Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, Draymond Green, and whoever else is in that group. But that big three, was all homegrown. So there are different ways of going about it, and hopefully for the Wolves this works. I, quite frankly, have not watched a lot of the NBA playoffs. I've been spending my time watching Twins. As you know, I'm a big baseball guy. I'm less of an NBA fan as a college basketball fan, so I did see the game winner last night by the kid from Dallas, and what an exciting finish that was. And as it gets closer to semifinals, I'll probably start tuning my radar a little bit closer into the NBA.
Well, let's move on to the Twins then. It was a bit of a rocky road last week. The Kansas City Royals have given Twins some troubles throughout the season, but do you feel like they're back on track?
Yeah, for sure. And they took two or three from the Royals here over the weekend. And I want to say they're like, what, 7-3 in their last 10. So, they're in great shape. This is the hard thing to imagine, Nate, is tonight's game is the halfway point of the season. Mm-hmm. Think about that. Mm-hmm. Game 30 tonight, 60-game regular season. So we're halfway. I mean, the Twins, knock on wood, would really have to, have some real things go the wrong way not to make the postseason now. Doesn't mean you can't strive to win the division and get a good seed and play a weaker team. I think that's important. Home field edge really doesn't matter other than the home team gets the last at bat, which, you know, baseball is about the only sport that literally changes the structure of its game based on who's at home, right? The mm-hmm. home team has the last at bat. That's an advantage. So you want to try to be home field, all that stuff. But I'm excited about it. I've been paying attention and watching, and it's just great, frankly, to have baseball back in my mind. And I think this Twins team, look, Donaldson has not been really a factor yet. If he gets healthy toward the postseason time, that's going to be big. Odorizzi just got injured. They'll get Pineda back. If Odorizzi comes back later on, I thought it was an encouraging start by Barrios the last time out. Thing is, it's like there's not a lot of time to, you know, mess around here. I mean, we're halfway through. You know, postseason's going to be here before we know it.
And you can hear the Twins, of course, right here on KATE tonight at 6:10 p.m. against the Cleveland Indians. Mike, the Minnesota Vikings have reported a dozen false positive COVID-19 tests, along with a bunch of other teams in the NFL as well. What does that mean for the progress for the league going forward, just a few weeks away from the start of the season?
Well, the good news is they were false. If they were positive, if they were real, that would be a real roadblock. That would be a real problem. That would be a public relations problem as well. But the fact of the matter is that I think these teams have they're putting resources into some pretty unique ideas to try to make sure that they're safe. Nothing is foolproof, but certainly their alarms went off when they saw 77 positives yesterday when they had hardly had any. And as it turns out, it sounds like, I think the NFL Network's reporting that the lab in New Jersey was somehow contaminated. By the samples were contaminated. So all 77 retook tests and all 77 came back negative. So the good news is it really has no impact. Those guys are going to be back practicing today with all their teams. In fact, one team yesterday did rapid testing for the four guys that they had. I can't remember which team. They passed it and they just let them practice. They didn't even wait around because it was pretty apparent that this was a mistake by the lab somehow. So I don't think it's a roadblock at all. I think it's fine. They're going to all practice and move on. The lab's going to have to figure something out to make sure it doesn't happen again. But the NFL has kind of taken baseball's approach in that it's not bubbled. These guys are going home after practice to their families. They're trying to stay careful. But what they have done is put some resources behind some things. They have tracking devices. So if you're around someone, you're too close to someone, your tracking device will go off at the facility. If you've been around, like if you and I are on the Vikings and we're teammates and we're standing talking to each other for over 15 minutes, our wristband goes off to say, get away from each other. That's too long. So there's some unique things that they're doing. They're temperature checking, questionnaires, all that before they get there. So far, so good. I think the NFL will have a season, and I don't, we'll see how it continues. Are there going to be hiccups? Absolutely. As we've said from the get-go, this is all going to be strange. And will there be bumps along the road? And are we going to have to fly by the seat of our pants? Of course. But that's what happens when there's an international health pandemic. Life will be altered, and that means the norm will be altered. That means that, it doesn't mean it's going to be perfect. Like, people can't lose their minds if an NFL player tests positive. It's going to happen at some point.
What's the final record for the Minnesota Vikings this year?
Good question. I think
it's that time of year. It's that time of year, Mike. We got to tell people what's going to happen.
No doubt. I think they're hurt by the fact that I think they had one of the better home field edges, and obviously that won't be the case. I mean, they're going to play home games, but they won't have fans. So. I think football more than any other sport, maybe basketball, the NBA, those, I mean, we saw that shot last night by Doncic go in and the place, I mean, the team erupted. So I think there's emotion and intensity, but I think football more than any, maybe has the impact, the fans have as much of an impact on that as anything. There's teams that spend much of their week practicing with crowd noise, getting fed through a PA system just to prepare for it. And that's not going to be a factor now, unless, as Mike Zimmer said last week, there is some discussion that a home team might be allowed to funnel in crowd noise, just taped pre-recorded crowd noise over the loudspeakers, which of course has been illegal up to now, but just to create some atmosphere. So we'll see if that's the case and how that goes, but that still is going to be different. That said, look, it's like the NHL, it's like the Major League Baseball, it's like NBA. There have been some really exciting moments in all of those without fans. Would it be better with? Of course. But I think the NFL will be able to pull it off. And Vikings record without the home field edge, it's a good question. I'm a little worried about the defensive backs, the cornerbacks. You're counting on two, maybe three rookies back there. And, that opener against Aaron Rodgers will probably not be easy. I'll put the over under. We'll do it this way. I'll put the over under on wins at 9.5, and I'll take the over.
All right, there you have it. Mike Grimm with us here on KATE, talking Gophers and whatever else we want to talk about every single Monday here on Kate Radio. Thanks as always for calling in, Mike. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, look forward to it, Nate. Thank you.